Welcome to Amplify, a podcast about the future of Europe, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. We cover the latest developments in European integration, including the Conference on the Future of Europe and the Next Generation EU Post-Pandemic Recovery Plan. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. This episode is a conversation with Hannah Deasy and Alex Conway of the IIEA, that is the Institute for International and European Affairs. With the IIEA, they were involved in organizing one very important part of the Conference on the Future of Europe, specifically the Citizens' Panel on a Stronger Economy, Social Justice and Jobs, Education, Culture, Youth and Sport, and Digital Transformation. In this conversation, recorded on July 5th, they talk about that remarkable experience. I'm here in conversation with Hannah Deasy and Alex Conway of the Institute for International and European Affairs, which is a mouthful, that's the IIEA. And could I ask the two of you to briefly just introduce yourselves and tell us what your role is of the IIEA.
Hi, Ian. Lovely to chat to you. My name is Hannah Deasy, and I'm the Communications Director at the Institute of International and European Affairs.
I'm Alex Conway. I am the EU Affairs and Global Europe Researcher at the IIEA.
Now, we're here because Alex and Hannah have both been involved in quite a remarkable experience that is helping to run the Citizens' Assembly that was part of the Conference on the Future of Europe. And it was a Citizens' Assembly that culminated in a meeting in Dublin that took place in late February. Now, Alex, can I start with you and just ask you briefly, can you describe what is the Conference on the Future of Europe and what is the role of the citizens' assemblies within that overall conference process?
Sure thing. Thanks, Ian. So the Conference on the Future of Europe was a one-year-long deliberative public consultation exercise across the EU, covering all 27 member states, across all the languages, and trying to get a broad cross-representation of European society based on age, gender, background, urban, rural, and sort of to make it as representative as possible with a weighting on the future. So there was an over-representation of youth, those between 16 to 25. And it covered a broad range of topics: climate change, environment, health, stronger economy, social justice, employment, digital, democratic policy, migration, education, culture, youth, and sport. So it was a huge range of topics. And those were broken up into four individual panels that tackled those topics in groups. And those were submitted and discussed via what we called citizens' panels. So that was 200 people. From across the Europe, across representative section, and you had four of those that dealt with subgroupings of the topics I just mentioned, as well as an online platform that was available in all the EU languages. This was done in a broader context of trying to increase democratic engagement with the European project and public engagement and involvement with it.
And then just briefly, Alex, just to kind of explain where it fits into the conference process. And now I misspoke. I guess I call them citizens' assemblies, but they're citizens' panels. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the terminology. Yeah, okay. But it does draw on the Irish example of the citizens' assemblies.
Mm-hmm. You have these four citizens' panels that are meeting across Europe, and then they are, as I understand it, coming up with recommendations that will feed into the conference plenary, and the plenary is kind of the final kind of the general kind of decision-making body for the conference.
Exactly, yeah. So you have these three citizens panels of 200 citizens, and they meet three times. And the first two times they meet in Strasbourg, and the final time they meet in different cities around the EU. So you had Dublin, Warsaw, Maastricht, and the final one was in Strasbourg itself as well. And so you have the first session is essentially setting out what are the important subtopics within the areas they've been allocated, and allocating various work streams is what they call them, so specific areas to focus on, like employment policy or say housing, something like that. And then the second time they meet, they essentially go into it a bit more in depth. I try to find the real pressing issues within those topics and start the process of emerging a recommendation, a sort of a draft policy recommendation. This should, X should be done. And then the final session, which was the one for the panel that we were involved in Dublin Castle, that was the third session of that panel. And that was essentially crafting final recommendations. So prioritizing what it is they wanted to focus on, drafting a recommendation, and also getting feedback from other groups within that panel to say, this is what our group has come up with on our topic. What do you think? Essentially. Sorry, I think I misspoke there. I meant to say there were four panels, and the final one met in Florence. And to say that each of the four panels met twice in Strasbourg and then once in a separate European city. So Dublin, Maastricht, Warsaw, and Florence. Sorry, just to clarify that. Apologies.
Right, got it. No, that's fine. So next question, I guess I'll turn to Hannah for this next question. So the specific citizens panel that met in Dublin, can you tell us a bit about kind of the organizational challenges of bringing 200 people from 27 member states across the EU to Dublin over a weekend?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. Well, I suppose, you know, the organizational challenges of such an event, you know, would always be significant because it's a large scale event with many different people, with many different languages and linguistic requirements in terms of translation and interpretation. But in this instance, it was, of course, even more complex because of COVID. And in fact, you know, that's something that the whole conference did suffer from, in the sense that there were many delays. So when the Conference on the Future of Europe was first announced as the latest iteration of the European institutions' engagement with citizens, it was pre-pandemic. So first of all, the pandemic put a major hold on it. So we actually had a speech in the IIEA in 2019 from the Vice President of the European Commission, who led out on this, Dubravka Suica, where she outlined what the whole process would look like. That was in early 2020. So then, obviously, we all know what happened. The whole thing was put on pause. When then the pandemic seemed to be in enough control for the organization to go forward, we got involved by pitching really Dublin as one of the potential locations for an in-person meeting of one of the citizens panels. And we were selected along with the College of Europe in Natalin, Poland, outside of Warsaw, the IPA organization and University of Maastricht in the Netherlands, and the European University Institute in Florence. There's a real desire from the organizers in Brussels to make sure that there was geographic representation of the meetings that would take place in the member states. So that all started back in summer 2021. So there was a very long lead in for the organizational process, but our panel was meant to meet in person in Dublin in December. And in early November, it became increasingly clear that that would be really, really difficult. You know, if we all cast our minds back, though it's hard to remember what was what and what stage of the pandemic now. That was when, you know, only people with vaccinations would be entitled to be at an indoor event. You know, there was no way people who weren't vaccinated were going to be able to fly unless they were doing negative tests, you know, every day almost. The complexities became quite overwhelming. And there was also a significant concern that we had around that it wasn't appropriate to host such an event, right? That there would be a real risk to citizens and that that would be really counterproductive to trying to engage with citizens in a positive way. So it was pushed out to February 2022. So that was the number one organizational challenge, was dealing with COVID. Number two was, I suppose, you know, 200 citizens from all across the union, as I said, multilingual capacity, and that's quite complicated. But there was an enormous willingness on part of the institutions in Brussels, who had set up a joint secretariat between the Council, the Parliament, and the Commission to run the Conference on the Future of Europe, to use all of their facilities to make those challenges, those organizational challenges, and particularly around interpretation, work smoothly. I couldn't understate the enthusiasm among people working in the institutions for this process, which was really refreshing and a lovely thing to work with. know, they were genuinely engaging with how do we best get citizens' views into this process. And they really had deep respect for that. And that was a fascinating thing to observe and to see. Now, that also made it really difficult to, on the organizational front, but nothing that wasn't surmountable, you know, because there were so many people involved in trying to make it run as smoothly as possible.
Yeah, and I should say congratulations for being part of organizing such a successful event, despite all these challenges. So it's a feather in your cap and the cap of the IIEA for being chosen for this massive task.
Right. Well, we were super keen to do it and be involved because our mission is sharing ideas and shaping policy. And that is tends to be led by experts and policymakers and thought leaders. And this was a really innovative way to also be fulfilling our mission of sharing ideas and shaping policy, but with citizens. And I have to say that when you look at this process in the Conference on the Future of Europe, flaws and complexities as it may have had, and I'm sure we'll get into some of those later on, when you compare it back to the 2001 Convention on the Future of Europe or the Juncker Commission's Citizens' Dialogues, this is on a whole other scale in terms of substantive engagement with citizens in a deliberative process.
That's very interesting. That kind of leads me into the next question. And perhaps either one of you could answer this, or maybe both want to answer it. Just want to ask about kind of the methodology of the citizens' panels, like the way, the thinking about the way they're organized, I understand it's quite a specialized thing, being a running something of this kind, where you have, you're allowing citizens to, you're making, enabling citizens to deliberate with one another about these really important questions.
Yeah, I mean, I'll let Alex come in on the detail of this, but one thing I'll just reference is, I suppose, this really interesting deliberative consortium that was appointed by the Joint Secretariat. There's a lot of long names involved in this process that aren't immediately understandable, but when you dig deep and work out what they are fascinating. So the deliberative consortium was an advisory panel that was also involved in the delivery of each citizens panel. And it brought together a number of different organizations that are specialist in deliberative democracy and citizens engagement from different member states. So there was a Spanish organization called Deliberativa, a German one, IFOC, a French one called Mission Publique that has been very involved in the various citizens assemblies that have taken place in France over the past few years, and a Danish organization. And each one of those organizations took the lead on a different panel in terms of running out like the facilitators, the moderators, the note takers, the collection of recommendations, the annotation of recommendations at different stages. That's obviously quite complex and enormously important to keep, maintain the citizens' trust that all of that is done really accurately. So they had that role, but then they equally advised on the design of the process. And the fact that the institutions went to experts in deliberative democracy, I think speaks volumes about the attempt, certainly, to engage in a really meaningful way. Now, I will hand over to Alex for a further drill down on the methodology.
Sure. Thanks, Anna. And to say, my role during the panel in Dublin was I was a note taker or an assistant facilitator, which essentially meant that I helped to run one of the small working groups that was discussing a specific topic. So taking down their comments and trying to synthesize them and help them form them into policy recommendations, essentially, and helping just the smooth running of discussions and of the group dynamic and that sort of thing. And our group was specifically focused on the harmonization of educational standards. And then that ended up drilling down into primary education and into foreign language acquisition. And I think what was interesting was you're paired with a facilitator. So you're paired with someone who's got good experience running a similar kind of event. I was paired with an Irish guy who'd been involved in running some of the citizens' assemblies in Ireland. So significant experience there. And I think a lot of it...
Who's that?
Oh, that was a guy called Mick McGuffin, barrister. And that a lot of that, I think, hangs on the kind of the personality and the style of the facilitator, how much they're willing to intervene or sort of push people on to say, actually, no, that was a really interesting thought and a comment. Can you develop that? Or I think we need to hear from the person down the back that it's something to say, or we haven't heard from this side of the table. So it's essentially keeping that discussion and that conversation going and shaping the discussion and the thoughts and the language into a recommendation that's solid, clear, and actionable, essentially. And so you'd have about,
Well, I was just going to say, so you feel like you're witnessing real deliberation in real time?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you have about 12, 14 people across 4 or 5 languages, so it can be complex, but the instantaneous translation is very good, to be honest with you. It really does help, and it really works. And you have, whenever you take your written down inputs, you put them down, and you've got the screen behind you, and that screen has translation as well. So you put your text in English, or whatever language you're working through in the group. And that also comes up in the other languages of the group you're in. So for me, it would come up in Spanish, and it would come up in Swedish, and it would come up in German, and so on, or come Polish. And you'd have that all available on the screen, and everyone can read it and say, actually, no, that doesn't work in Polish. This is, you need to change that word, or that's great. So I thought it was very good.
Can I just ask a follow-up question about the translation? I understand, was that done remotely?
Yes. So the instantaneous translation was done remotely, and they were all based in Strasbourg, I think it was, and Brussels, I think. And so you had people across those two locations coming in over your ears. And then the written translation was done by a program on the screen. So that was just machine translation. But the actual audio one, so everyone has headsets on, and they're all speaking into microphones, and that's getting picked up and then being fed back.
That's remarkable. That actually worked.
Yeah, amazingly, it really worked. You know, it's a little eerie or sort of strange to start with, but then it becomes second nature and you don't even think of it. The only thing is just to remind people to keep their headphones on, because maybe someone takes off their headphones and speaks to their colleague, and it's two Swedish people, say, and they speak to each other in Swedish. And you have to go, let everyone understand, let everyone in the group find out. So you put them back on, and then you get the translation into Spanish or Polish or Portuguese or whatever languages are around the table.
So can you just, maybe this is an interesting example. Like, so it should be, we should say that the Citizens Assembly, the one that you, that was run in Dublin, was mostly about the economy, right? But more than that.
Yeah, I'd say the economy was one of the big topics that was discussed at the one in Dublin, but it covered a lot of them. So it also covered social justice and employment policy, jobs. It also covered digital policy. It also covered education, which was the area that I was working in. And it also covered cultural policy, youth policy, and sport policy. So it was quite broad and diverse, and you had a real range. And then each working group would have a specific question under one of those particular headings.
And did you, so the working group that you were in, some recommendations emerged from that, did they?
Yeah, we did. I've got them here. We ended up coming down to 2 recommendations. So you get a list of topics or ideas, and you essentially prioritize them. And that's quite analog. You vote with stickers on a board, and then the topic with the most stickers is the one you go for. So it's really asking people, what are you most interested and engaged in? And then that's where we're going to spend our time and devote our energies to working on. So the first one that came out was recommending that all EU member states agree and adopt a certified minimum standard of education in core subjects for primary schools to ensure that there's a standard equitable level of primary education across the EU, regardless of member state. And then the second one, which was focused on foreign languages, and that was a good bit of discussion about that, ended up saying, we recommend that English is taught to a certifiable standard as a core subject in primary schools across all EU member states. The rationale for that was that you have at least one language that you can speak to another EU citizen in. So someone from Portugal can speak to someone in Estonia, and then your lingua franca is English. That's the logic behind that.
Right. And were there any French people in the panel that objected to that?
There were no French people in my group, but there were some strong opinions about, well, is English really the right one to be going for? And then you get maybe sidetracked into a discussion about Brexit, and then the jobs of the facilitators to say, we're not discussing Brexit, we're discussing educational policy, and what is your rationale behind this? But I think the fact that the UK might have left may have helped that a little bit, to say it wasn't the language of any one major large European member state. Ireland and Malta still speak English and use it a lot, but it was kind of a language that everyone was interested in learning and that they already had a basis in, and that it was a useful milieu to speak to everyone else in. But yeah, there were other proposals saying, why not Spanish? Why not German? So there was a little bit of back and forth on that, or why not French? So that was quite interesting.
And did you follow the recommendations? Did they end up going to the plenary?
Yeah, so they ended up going into the plenary, and then they, so the plenary is both citizens, but also you have representatives of the European Parliament, from national parliaments, from EU bodies and EU adjacent bodies, and from, you also get people coming in on specific topics. You have representatives from Ukraine or the Western Balkans and the like, and that would be a broad discussion format. So as you say, here's what this panel has proposed, what do we think? They would be filtered in through working groups. So essentially the same idea, so smaller subsections, which would be citizens and MPs and MEPs from European Parliament and national parliaments and the like. And then they essentially refine those further. So you get that sort of policy-making input as well. So you can see that some of them did end up going further on and have entered up in the final report, which has been submitted to the EU institutions, the Commission, the Council, and the Parliament. So you can see questions about things like the minimum wage has now ended up in that, or questions about certifiable standards in primary education. So you can find those, that language has now filtered down into the ultimate proposals, which are with the institutions.
And then you, either one of you can answer this question. What happens next?
$64,000 question.
Yeah, exactly. I have to say that there's a sub-trend in Conference on the Future of Europe memes at the moment, as a result of this, that seek to answer that question, actually, Ian, what happens next? And Alex and I enjoy looking at those semi-regularly. It's look, there's no easy answer to that question. And I think we, Alex and myself, both have views on this. One thing I will say is that, you know, when we were in the plenary sessions of the citizens panels in Dublin Castle, one thing that was really notable was the enthusiasm citizens had for the process. I mean, I have to say, the whole thing was like an antidote to cynicism. You know, you attend conferences, and we organize events with policymakers all the time. It's our bread and butter as an organization. But sometimes, you know, audiences can be a bit jaded, you know, at conferences, especially all day conferences. They're long, stuffy room, you know, they walk in and out, they do a bit of networking in the afternoon instead of sitting in listening to the experts. And watching the citizens and their enthusiasm to be in the room, you know, one stage I thought a coffee break was happening, and I went back into the room, and the diligence with which the citizens were reading the recommendations and voting with their stickers was truly remarkable. And I was discussing it with David Farrell, and he said, you know, felt very similar in the Irish citizens assemblies, but to see that from so many different nationalities and the seriousness with which the citizens took their task was fantastic, and really, really different. The issue then is, of course, that they were also all quite concerned as to what's going to happen to our recommendations, and will they be taken seriously, or will they just be put in a nice report and put that will be put in a bookshelf and that will be the end of it. And the innovation, one of the innovations this time, was that citizens ambassadors attended the full plenaries of the Conference on the Future of Europe, so with the national parliamentarians and appointed European parliamentarians as well, you had citizen ambassadors from each panel standing up in the European Parliament and presenting their recommendations, so as to give them the same level of respect and voice within the generalized plenary. And as Alex has said, a number of the recommendations have come through. But what happens to the overall set of recommendations and how seriously will they be taken by policymakers does remain up for debate. And there's you know, real divergence then, of course, within the institutions, and particularly within the council, I think I'd be correct in saying our different member states have different views on how what should happen next. And Alex has been following this in the institute.
I just had a side question for you, because as it turns out, the war in Ukraine broke out literally the day before the meeting in Dublin. Can you tell me how that affected the atmosphere?
There was a really significant impact on the atmosphere at the event throughout the weekend, actually, by the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. And that was visible at several levels. And the citizens themselves, you know, felt extremely impacted. And of course, when you have people from every member state, some of those are coming from very close to the Ukrainian border, of course, and from member states that have totally different perspectives on the proximity of that war than we might have in Ireland. But all the same, regardless of nationality, there was a huge desire to stand in solidarity with Ukrainian citizens that completely sprang from the citizens themselves. And the organizers then wanted to make sure to both acknowledge that war in Europe had, you know, begun again, but also to not stifle how the citizens wanted to express it themselves. So, for example, as would be standard at an event like this, there was, you know, a group photo call happening in the morning, and the citizens themselves went out and bought Ukrainian flags. That the organizers had nothing to do with that. And, you know, the line that was agreed the night before among the organizers was, let the citizens mark this however they wish. And then one thing that was added into the program was an open mic moment in the opening session of the plenary to allow citizens to stand up and give their view on what was happening, which was extremely moving. And then, of course, it was also acknowledged in the speeches from the high level political representatives who were there. So Vice President of the European Commission, Dubravka Suica, the Lord Mayor of Dublin, Alison Gilliland, and MEP Guy Verhofstadt, they all spoke about it in their speeches. So it was palpable. What I have to say that I found most moving, one of the most moving things about it, was hearing the organizers talk about it the night before, and just the way that, the you know, these are people who work, their daily bread and butter is working in the EU institutions and, you know, could be called faceless bureaucrats in certain quarters. And they were so visibly shaken up by it, not that they wouldn't have been expecting it, but just that the reality is that it's easy to say Europe is a peace project, but seeing the impact of war in Europe on people who work in the European institutions every day, there was something quite unique about that. You know, they were really very conscious of this process is actually the exact opposite of what any kind of authoritarian grouping of states would ever want to encourage. And we have a responsibility to let the citizens speak and elevate their views, because ultimately what we are trying to do is strengthen democracy.
Right. So this the process itself was an answer to authoritarianism.
Some of them felt very strongly that yes, absolutely, that was, you know, it was a symbol of how different European values are.
That's fascinating. I'm aware of, I've got my eye on the time. I just wanted to kind of also give Alex a chance to answer the question of what comes next. I know that the conference recommendations are now in the hands of the EU institutions, and you don't have to talk at length about that, but you might want to comment on it. But also I'm interested in the idea that this kind of consultation could become a permanent part of the way the EU consults with citizens. You want to comment on that?
Sure, yeah. And again, I have to say, it is a little bit opaque what exactly happens next, but so there's been some interesting documents and publications that have come out. So one of them is what's called a communication from the European Commission, which is essentially what it sounds like. It's a publication saying, this is what we think is happening, this is what we'd like to do. And it's the first sort of formal institutional follow-up on the conference, and it's quite interesting. The Commission is essentially saying they're going to follow what they call the follow-up principle, which is to follow the proposals made by citizens in the most direct and pragmatic way possible. And they've divided up, so they've analyzed every proposal that's come out of it and the individual measures, and they've broken them up into four areas. Those where something's already happening or has already been put in place. So the climate law, for example, for climate targets for environmental and climate goals. Things like the Digital Services Act or Digital Markets Act to regulate social media or online markets. Proposals that are currently in the legislative process between the member states and the European Parliament. And that's things like the Pact on Migration and Asylum. We're going to manage the EU's external borders. And then they got into the more interesting bits, which is essentially what's coming down the tracks and how that stuff's been affected by the citizens' proposals. So you see planned legislative proposals coming out from the Commission on media independence or on securing the critical raw materials you need for wind turbines or for batteries to get that green and digital transitions and sort of transformations to a greener, more digitally connected economy across the EU. And then new areas that the Commission is going to start investigating and getting stuck into as a result of what citizens asked for and are looking for. And that's really broad and diverse, things like mental health, things like food security, things like animal welfare, things like cryptocurrency regulation. So that was really interesting to see that. That's quite a pragmatic, direct response to say, you told us what you want, we're going to go for it. So there's going to be more information on that at the State of the Union speech by the Commission President von der Leyen in September. And we should expect, again, as you said, there's sort of a permanence element. I think there's going to be two ways that's going to come about. One, there's an expected feedback session in autumn 2023, where essentially the three institutions, the Council, the Parliament, and the Commission, say what they've done and explain themselves. So I think that's quite interesting that that's going to happen. You get a sort of a hearing. And then the other one is that the Commission is committed to making citizens more involved in policymaking. So they want to build on that model and of having, again, the same idea, 800 randomly chosen representative citizens to deliberate and to make recommendations on key proposals. And they want to start that in 2022. So there's not a lot of information about that yet, but I imagine in the autumn, we'll see much more coming out about that. So I thought that was quite interesting. You have to say, yeah, there is a sort of commitment on the Commission side of it. And the other institutions are a bit less detailed, but the Parliament backs it strongly. And the Council, as Hannah says, the member states are a bit more split, let's say.
Right. So in other words, watch this space.
In essence, yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the different member states sort of filter out between them. And again, as Hannah says, it's been great fodder for memes, I have to admit. So it's hard to represent those sort of audibly visually in an audible format. But I can guarantee you, if you go onto Twitter, there's some excellent meme accounts that really explain this really well, better than I can.
Okay. Well, I'm conscious of the time, and I would encourage all the listeners to go to the IIEA website to look for updates about what's going on with the Conference on the Future of Europe. Also, the DCU Brexit Institute and our Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild will be working on this as well. All that's left is for me to thank Alex and Hannah for your time. It's been absolutely fascinating, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Ian.
Thanks a million. Pleasure.
You've been listening to Amplify, which is made with the support of the European Union's Erasmus Plus program and the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative, although these institutions do not necessarily endorse its contents. It is produced by the DCU Brexit Institute in association with the Jean Monnet Center of Excellence Rebuild. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano.